Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of the Speculist weblog, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. If you want to type a little more and put in blog there, you can do blog.speculist.com. You get straight to the good stuff that way. On this podcast and on the Speculist, we deal with emerging technologies, emerging possibilities. We talk about the future. We talk about what we think is going to be a bright future, a future that we're all going to want to live to see. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me, as always, is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. Once again, that's going to be my stock answer, by the way.
Super fantastic.
I'm super fantastic every week. If one week I say something other than super fantastic, there'll be a real story to tell, right?
Okay, all right. Well, I suppose it's possible, you know, if you just say fantastic, we'll know that, you know, something's bothering you real bad. Huh?
That's right. I'm way down.
Okay. All right.
If I'm just fantastic or just super, either way.
So. I guess so, yeah.
So, how are you? You got your Valentine's Day planning all in place. You know, this is for us married guys. We got to be very careful about these things. It creeps up on you faster than you think it's going to. Are you all set for the big day?
Well, Valentine falls in the middle of the week this week, and if you've got a bunch of kids like Sherilyn and I have, it's a school night, and so you don't
all right.
plan a big romantic date on like a Thursday. I think it's Thursday this week, right?
I believe so.
I will.
You should know that, though.
I ought to know, just off the top of my head. But I'll bring her flowers. I'll do something like that. But we actually had our big date night last night, and so we had went out for just a fantastic meal last night, and just had a good time. And so, if you're ever in the Shreveport area, you need to check out the 1800 restaurant. They cook things in an oven at 1800 degrees. Now, how they managed to do that and not burn it, where these steaks, I don't know. I have no clue. But, I mean, it was like cutting through butter, and wonderful meal.
Just so. I guess, in and out really fast with an 1800 degree. Yeah.
I guess so, and managed to cook it all the way through and not charbroil it on the outside and leave it raw on the inside. I don't know how they did it, but it was very good. So.
Well, that sounds great, and it's called 1800 in Shreveport.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Actually,
well,
it's Bossier, right across the river. What's that?
I was going to say, if anyone affiliated with the place is listening, we are giving you an ad here now. So,
that's right. It's
free
local, ad.
We can talk. It's free this time.
Yeah, that's right.
This time it's free, but
we had a great time, and so that's that sort of takes the pressure off. I can just show up with some roses or something on Thursday, and I'm in the clear.
Are you sure it takes the pressure off? You see, that's the other thing now.
It's a risky thing, Valentine's Day,
isn't it? It truly is. Now, one thing you got going for you with the kids, okay, with the four boys at home, is actually a thing you have to do and a thing you've got going for you, is that they've all got to get their mom something and have to do cards or something like that. But
that's
then
right.
There's this whole cute Valentine's Day thing going on too, which I think would also sort of take some of the pressure off you because they have to deliver too a little bit there.
A little bit, but dad's got to be involved in that, so you know how that
right.
goes. So
it's a double-edged sword. Yeah, I was. Just telling you before the podcast started that I had in fact figured out exactly what I was going to do for the specky wife. I had it all sorted out, had my plan ready to go, was about to execute, and then she came and told me what I would be doing for her for Valentine's Day. So,
well, now the pressure's off. You just do what she tells you to, and then all's good, right?
Absolutely. What that lacks in spontaneity, it more than makes up for in risk management. And hey, what do you know? We happen to be doing a program about risk this evening, so do you see how we've neatly brought that into play there. In fact, we were going to have a friend from the Lifeboat Foundation on the program this evening, or at least we had been talking with a couple of different folks from that organization about being on. And it looks like we'll probably have someone on from Lifeboat either next week or in the very near future. But since we had already been blogging about topics that are related to risk, and since we had already been sort of talking about it amongst ourselves leading up to the program, we thought we would go ahead and talk about risk this evening.
That's right. And so I guess we should just launch straight on into it. The one that kind of caught my eye, Phil, was the article you wrote at The Speculist about how the European Union, is banning genetically modified food. And I guess the country that's really taking the lead on that is France, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, they have halted production of or allowing genetically modified corn. And this is, to me, a really excellent example of, and I think we've got several of these, examples of issues where, there definitely is an element of risk involved, and we need to become educated as to what that risk is, and we need to be able to make good decisions about how we mitigate against any risk involved. Where I feel that either through just common misconceptions or maybe some bad memes that get floated out there, or maybe with a little bit of help from the media, a very bad decision gets made. And to me, this is a case in point. We've got the French government halting genetically modified corn. A number of other countries, I think, in Europe are prepared to follow suit. Austria, Greece, and Hungary also highly suspicious of, dubious about, and ready to put curbs in place around genetically modified corn.
And this is after they've done studies to show, not just in the United States, but in Europe, done studies to show that it's perfectly safe. I suppose it would be possible, and quite easy actually, to genetically modify corn to be, say, poisonous. Insert a little piece of DNA from some poisonous plant, nightshade or something, into corn, and you'd have poisonous corn. But, number one, what would be the utility of that? Number two, if somebody was trying to do that to hurt somebody, there's easier ways to kill people, and poisons food supplies. And so, that's just not going, I just don't see that as any larger of a risk than just what food supply is anyway. But on the other hand, when you genetically modify corn, say, to be pest resistant, then you can cut down the amount of pesticides that you're poisoning the environment with. You can increase yields, and that's a big thing for farmers everywhere.
Absolutely, and particularly
in places like Africa.
Right. Well, you can modify corn so that it does not require, or any crop. I mean, corn is the example we're talking about here. But you can modify crops such that they are more conservative of water, that they don't that they don't require as much water in order to grow. And if you're in an arid country and you're just eking by trying to get crops to grow, that can make a huge difference. In fact, that can make all the difference between whether you're going to be able to grow a crop or not. And in fact, the quote I had from the news story that I was referring to when I wrote that blog post, it said, "The European Food Safety Authority says genetically modified products do not constitute a risk to human health or the environment, but some EU governments," and then including the suspects I just named, "are wary of biotechnology."
Yeah.
So this kind of irrational fear.
Right. It's not based on anything that can really put their finger on. Michael Darling is in the chat room, and he said he thinks the real problem is unintended consequences. I think that there is some risk with a genetically modified food, as there would be with other things. But I think the upside, this is my opinion, the upside of GM foods is so much greater than the potential downside. And so, particularly, here's a good example. I read this; it was about a year ago. I wish I had the site for it. I may be able to dig it up and put it in the show notes, but there was this African country that's having trouble feeding their own people, and anyway, they're growing food and selling it to France. Now, why they would want to sell what little food they have to France, I guess that's what you get when you got a top down You got a dictator in charge. He wants the money. He is not interested in feeding his people. But the bad thing is, when France says, okay, no GM food, he tells his farmers, okay, you can't have, GM crops at all because we don't want to disappoint our potential customers. And therefore, you have to just deal with the yields that you have. And so, they, instead of having higher yields and perhaps the potential of feeding France and themselves, they'll just feed France and you create a problem with feeding your own people that way. So,
well, and as if the first world hasn't put enough burden and hardship on third world farmers with the restrictions that we have on what we will buy from them and what we won't, to then go out and tell them, and by the way, crops that might be viable for you, no, you can't do that either.
Yeah.
It almost becomes outrageous. And, I see Michael's point about unintended consequences, and I think that none of this is to say that there is not an element of risk.
Right.
But this ban, let me give an analogy, because, there are unintended consequences with a lot of things, right? There are unintended consequences with taking food supplements. A lot of people, they take ginseng or ginkgo biloba, or there are a lot of different things. If you go to Whole Foods or Wild Oats or one of those markets, I mean, it's huge, the selection of those things. Now, there's no question that there can be adverse effects from taking some of these, taking them in the wrong combination, taking too many of them can lead to all kinds of ill effects. But this is the equivalent, of saying, therefore, all food supplements are banned.
Yeah.
Right. That's what this is like.
Which is obviously, if you do them correctly, then you can improve your health with them. And so, it's exactly right. You just have to know. You can't get out of bed without risk, and so you do your best to manage the risk and take the risks that have the greatest potential payoff. And I see GM modified foods as one of those risks that's worth taking. For that reason, so that's just my personal opinion on that. Particularly since these studies have come out lately, like in the last month or so, showing that there's just absolutely no problem with eating GM food. So, anyway,
right. Well, and in fact, I saw one. I touch on the idea of cloned meat in the story, and in fact, at this point, the FDA has said cloned meat and milk are okay, but no one seems to be rushing to. Market to say, yeah, we're going to sell either of those two products. And I think there's a lot of misperceptions around what cloning is, and I think there's just kind of a yuck factor associated with cloned meat. But people hear genetic, or they hear cloned, and they think, if I eat genetically modified corn, it's going to mess up my genes or something like that, right? If I eat meat from a cloned cow, I really can't imagine what people think is going to happen to them if they do that, what the downside of that one is. But I got an email not too long ago from a friend who insists on sending me political stuff, and I think he knows where I stand on most political stuff, but he sends me things anyway, so God bless him. A great guy. But this was about sugar from genetically modified beets. And
okay.
Just talking about, do you know they're selling us sugar from genetically modified beets? And I'm like, dude, I'm pretty sure by the time it's sugar, it's just like a molecule, right? It has no idea what kind of a beet it came from at that point. But
people will find things to be scared of. And, and again, it doesn't have to be rational.
Not only does it not have to be, it often seems to help if there's a little element of irrationality to the fear. Well, we're talking about various risks. We're going to be talking a little bit more about existential risks. This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and in our second half hour, we will be taking your calls. You can dial us at 347-215-8972. We'll be starting on calls, as I said, in the second half of the show. So a couple of other of these areas of risk that we've looked at in recent blog posts, one of them was, I think you may have seen the piece I did on alternatives to recycling, to standard waste recycling.
Yeah, I saw how Sweden is it Sweden?
Yeah.
Was that the country?
It is Sweden, yes.
Okay, that I mean, they were requiring, I mean, this was onerous. I mean, they were requiring people in Sweden apparently have to sort and clean their garbage. Before they can throw it away, it has to be cleaned. Plastics, glass, metal, I mean, all these, and they got like five bins that they keep in their garage or wherever, and then they have to haul them to the various recycling plants and everything. I think part of the problem there with their government is that they're not factoring in the cost of cleaning and sorting garbage that their citizens have to go through, and you're turning your population into waste management personnel, unpaid waste management personnel.
Exactly right. They're taking it as a sunk cost or a fixed cost or a cost that they don't have to consider because it's spread out and they can treat it as though it's free. But in fact, this is the point that the blogger made. This got picked up on Dig, and it was a hugely well-read piece on Dig. I was surprised because something critical of recycling isn't the sort of thing that usually makes it to the top of Dig, but this did, and it stayed up there for quite a while. The thing reminds the process that they've got in place for recycling, what it reminds me of is it's the argument that you have with your wife about why do you have to wash the dishes before you put them in the dishwasher, okay? I mean, it's that on a society level. Right. I mean, it's okay. We're going to recycle materials, but first you have to wash out your milk cartons before you can recycle them. It's absolutely astounding. So my point was, well, what if we, rather than recycling all this stuff, if it's going to require that much labor, what if we started pushing those kinds of materials in the direction of making cellulosic ethanol out of them? What if we recycled them as fuel rather than reclaimed those particular products? And I think you actually followed up on that with another related piece.
Yeah, and I completely agree with your idea, Phil, and I don't see any risk involved there. I mean, if we can turn our garbage into fuel, there's nothing wrong with that. That's just, that's cool. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, the risk that's associated with ethanol production, this came out like this last week. Apparently, by using corn ethanol, what that does is it pushes more corn production into places like Brazil. Of course, then they slash and burn rainforests, which releases a lot of carbon. And they did this study and they showed, because of this, when we use corn to make corn ethanol, then actually more carbon ends up being released as there's Michael's unintended consequence again, coming home to roost. So
just generally, there seem to be an awful lot of unintended consequences associated with making ethanol from corn.
Yes.
That seem to be the case? I mean, you see it driving food prices out of control. You see it causing, fluctuations in all these other markets that you weren't even thinking about or working on. So I would say that, corn ethanol is one of those maybe risky propositions where we really do have to look at the risk.
That's right.
We really do have to look at what we're trading versus what benefit we're getting from pursuing that. And I
have a concern, though, about that news and the way that study was. I mean, the study is... I think that the study was probably well done. It was, I don't doubt that what they show in the study was true. It's just the way it's reported. It makes it sound like all ethanol is bad. Ethanol is a bad thing. Well, we don't have to make ethanol from, corn. We could make it from other things, switchgrass. We could make it from the leftovers after the corn is harvested, the stalks and things like that. That's cellulosic ethanol. There's other things we can do. And as long as we're not using food itself or land that we grow food on, ethanol could be a good thing. And it could actually be carbon neutral because as plants grow, they're taking in carbon. And then, of course, you release the carbon maybe when you're burning the ethanol, but then that carbon could then be reabsorbed as you're growing more plants. So it
sure
could actually be a carbon neutral process. And so I think, I remain positive on ethanol because of that. So
Oh, I'm big on ethanol too. I think it's corn ethanol that I think might not be worth the risk. And it is one of the problems that we've encountered on the blog is when you start talking about ethanol, you immediately get into these discussions. People want to talk about, well, you know, corn and they want to talk about subsidies and all this stuff. And, you know, I'm ready to go on the record saying, yeah, I don't think any of that's a good idea. But it doesn't mean that using ethanol as a fuel to power cars isn't a good idea. Those are actually two different issues. And we don't want the risks associated with one to somehow become carried over into discussion of the whole topic. So I guess that's really the danger there, is not that there aren't real risks. There definitely are real risks with particularly with corn-based ethanol. But the question is, are we going to allow those risks drive the whole ethanol discussion, or are we going to talk about, you know, what makes sense in terms of can we reuse our garbage? And even if we say, okay, well, yeah, let's not recycle our paper. Let's turn our paper into cellulosic ethanol, and we can run our cars off that. Well, there's still going to be issues, because then the question becomes, well, now paper is a renewable resource, but will we start to deplete the resource if we're not recycling paper, but we're turning it into energy? Does that mean we have to cut down more trees? Is there an environmental impact there? All of those different things have to be looked at. And I don't know, frankly, if it is known, how big of an environmental impact the recycling of paper currently has, how much energy that takes. And, you know, it would be a very complex calculation to say, well, are we better off turning this into fuel, or are we better off putting it back into the cycle and making paper out of it once again? But if we're just stuck on subsidies and issues that are completely unrelated to that, we'll never know.
Right? That's right. We got to leave it open to try everything, and then we can make the determination later, after some of these things are perfected, what's better. You know, got to try it all.
So. Exactly. So speaking of trying it all, let's move on to another piece I wrote this week called The Children of Gilgamesh.
All right.
And I wanted to talk a whole lot about Gilgamesh because, for one thing, I feel like we owe it to him. after all the time we've spent talking about Beowulf.
That's right. We did not even bring him up before. So
we owe some of these other epic heroes equal time, I think. But the thing I pointed about Gilgamesh, one of the little oddities in that epic poem is that we are told that he is two-thirds divine and one-third human. And that's an interesting parentage to have, because most of us have two parents, and you got to kind of wonder, well, how did he come by a two-third, one-third ancestry?
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, there's no mixing of the blood that can you come up with a one-third of anything. You know, you're always divisible by two. Whatever characteristic there is, it's divisible by two.
Well, actually, I thought of a couple possible explanations for this. One is that maybe a divine ancestor counts twice. So
maybe,
if you have a divine ancestor and a human ancestor, okay, then you're one-third, two-thirds. The other one I got thinking was, work with me on the math here. Okay, so you have two parents. You have four grandparents, eight great-grandparents, 16 great-great-grandparents, and then 32, how many greats? Is that great-great-great-grandparents, right?
Okay.
Now, by the time you get there, let's say, just for argument's sake, that Gilgamesh had, you know, 20 divine great-great-great-grandparents and 12 human. He would have been roughly. Okay.
That's cool. I can see that now. Okay, yeah.
If they were rounding, okay, but that it's a highly sophisticated lineage. However, most people have read that to mean that there was something odd in Gilgamesh's parentage, and I was completely reminded of that when I read this story about British scientists who are creating human embryos that contain the DNA from two women and a man. So in effect, you've got a human embryo with three parents. Okay,
right.
This is the Gilgamesh effect here. Now, the scientists who are doing this, they're very clear in saying, look, we're not trying to alter genes. All we're trying to do is swap out a proportion of some bad ones for some good ones. So they're trying to establish that you can correct genetic problems by taking what would normally be thought of as an embryo with two parents and swapping in a little bit of genetic information from a third party just to correct a problem. However,
this is designer. This is basically designer babies. I mean, this is the science that would bring us that, isn't it?
That is exactly what this is.
Yeah.
And you know, the desire to replace those problem traits is a good one.
Yeah.
It's one I'm sure we would all agree with. But once again, Michael's unintended consequences echo here, because if you can produce an embryo with three parents, you can do one with, you know, 10 or 100 or any number that you can imagine. You can mix and match genetic traits from any number of contributing persons to provide the genetic makeup of this individual. And the question is, what are the risks associated with that? First off, you know, what kinds of problems might develop from these different traits being mixed? And also, you know, I think the other one you have to look at is, what are the social implications of something like that?
Well, I think that, you know, one problem with the crops that we have is that they're homogenous now.
Right.
And if a disease comes along, it could potentially wipe out all of, you know, our wheat or something, because we only have like one strain of wheat that we've chosen to use. What if, I mean, we make ourselves more homogenous as a race? You know, I mean, we decide, okay, nobody wants to be fat, so let's eliminate that. We want to eliminate this trait and that trait and so on and so forth. And pretty soon we're all running around looking exactly the same and, you know, having all the same traits. You know, could that potentially lead to a more homogenous population that would be more susceptible to disease or some problems like that? And that's, you know, that's one thing. And another thing is that a society that we would really want. I don't think that it's something really that much to worry about, because I lay out the argument and then I'm going to shoot it down, because I think that if once designer babies are possible, I think that people will become more different instead of more the same. I think
it seems to me
people will push off in different directions.
Right. If a newborn baby has the potential of having a dozen parents rather than two, it seems that if anything, people are going to become a lot more different rather than become a lot more the same. But I guess the point is that a lot of the same traits are going to be showing up over and over again. And one of the points that that I made in the blog post was, well, okay, so if a baby has a dozen parents, you know, what are the responsibilities of each of those 12 people towards that child? You know what I mean? And who does that child view, you know, not just in a legal sense, but in a social sense, in a biological sense? In a, I mean, so many questions arise around what it would mean for people to reproduce in this way that
I don't think
have any way of answering them.
I would think that you'd have two parents as always. Okay, this
right.
is just a guess. Okay, you have two parents as always that are completely responsible for the child. But then, you know, you go in, instead of reproducing the good old fashioned way, every baby is a test tube baby, and the baby is pretty much, you know, 95% the product of mom and dad. But let's throw in a little Arnold Schwarzenegger's ability to put on muscle mass. Let's throw in a little genius from Stephen Hawking, let's say. I'll make sure not to throw in the disease that he's suffering from, you know. In other words, gather traits from various people and then throw it in along with the obviously the normal traits of mom and dad. I think that that's where designer babies would go, but that's just, again, obviously a guess.
I think that's where it would start, but where it would go, I think, is anybody's guess. I think that's.
I suppose you could actually have all kinds of weird family situations where, you know, three people go together to make a third baby, basically. Who knows? That could be
right. You know, and you know, it's complicated enough in a world where families splinter and people don't know who's related to whom. I mean, if you throw into the mix there that a person could have an indeterminate number of parents. You could be meeting complete strangers all the time who were actually various, you know, a second cousin or, you know, a half sibling, or you wouldn't even know what for sure. I mean, it seems like there are risks that way that people might almost have to start carrying around a pedigree just to make sure that they weren't marrying the wrong person. Of course, it wouldn't matter if once they got married, their decision was also to just pick a whole bunch of different genetic material and make a kid that way. But it's a very, not Orwellian, it's the other guy, Brave New World. Aldous Huxley, is that right?
Huxley,
kind of a view of the future, and it's kind of hard to get your head around. At any rate, I think there are definitely risks associated that we haven't identified yet that will definitely come to the fore as we get closer on these kinds of technologies being developed. This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Phil Bauermaster and Stephen Gordon, we're talking about different kinds of risk. And at this point, Stephen, I want to go ahead and open up the phone lines. If anyone wants to call in and talk to us about risk, that number is 347-215-8972. And while we're looking to see if anyone calls in, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about we've been talking about risks that are iffy or so-so, that there's some risk, but maybe people are exaggerating the risk or maybe they're misunderstanding the risk. Let's talk about a completely different kind, which is what we would have gotten into tonight had our friends from Lifeboat Foundation been on, existential risk.
These are the biggest risks of all. And
right. These are the biggies.
Yeah. Obviously, if you know one of these concerns comes to pass, then we're either out of here or we face such a setback that perhaps civilization could come to an end. So, anyway, yeah, here are the big ones. And I just looking through the kind of risks that these guys are concerned about, and this is the Lifeboat Foundation, that you know the ones that they are concerned about are things like nuclear war, some biotechnological risk like engineering a virus or something like that. I mean, these are the big things that could wipe us out. So.
Absolutely, and we should point out when we talk about existential risk, we're talking about at a societal or civilizational or species or even planet level existential risk, because there are different kinds of existential risk. It was interesting. I was looking at the Wikipedia article on this subject, where I always begin looking at topics. Wikipedia is a great place to start, is my view on Wikipedia. And there was a neat chart there. Reminded me a little bit of some of the stuff I've done on practical time travel, where you talk about your spheres of influence, and you talk about, you know, what your future will be versus what the future of your immediate community will be versus the future of, you know, the entire planet. And risk works the same way. So you can have those risks that apply directly to you, those that apply to your community, and then those that apply to the whole planet or to all of humanity. And then there's the severity of the risk. So, you know, a risk that applies to me is that I might be late for work tomorrow, and that's just me, and that's not an existential risk. On the other hand, if I'm commuting, I actually face a level of existential risk every time I get out on the highway.
True.
Because
yeah.
As an individual.
But that's not a community-wide existential risk, because there's basically no chance that everyone in your community is going to be involved in a fatal car accident.
That's right. That would be an existential risk that applies to the community as a whole, but only to individuals within the community as a whole. That's exactly right.
Right.
Whereas what we're talking about now is all the way over in the far upper right-hand corner of that chart, and we're talking about the, you know, absolutely destructive risks that apply to the entire human community, as it were. And as you mentioned, nuclear risk is one of those. Biotechnological risk is another. Nanotechnology and artificial intelligence. These are the four that Michael Anisimov listed on his blog, and I think as good categories for talking about these risks, those are probably a good way to start. It's a slightly different breakdown than what we see from Bill Joy in the article that he did in Wired a few years back, called The Future Doesn't Need Us, which you and I have talked about before. He
right.
had it down to three categories, and those are the three categories that Kurzweil likes to use, and those are essentially GNR, genetics, nanotech, and robotics, meaning the artificial intelligence. But Michael has added nuclear risk, which I think is very much on point to be looking at that as a potential existential risk. It might not necessarily be existential for all of human civilization, but it certainly is for individual nation states and for our economy as we know it, and basically for our world as we know it.
Right.
The other three, I think, biotechnology, nanotech, and artificial intelligence, those all can pose threats to the very level of civilization, right? Could human civilization survive? So, now does this make me a hypocrite, Stephen? I'll put it to you, that I would list biotechnology as a huge existential risk for humanity, and yet still I'm miffed with the EU for banning genetically modified corn.
Not at all. Not at all. Biotech is not just one thing, obviously. Genetically modified foods is just one little part of what biotech is. Biotech is also the potential of putting together a virus that would kill us all. And, you know, the scary thing about that is that, you know, let's say a weapons of mass destruction. In the past, it was always had to be a state actor. You know, you had to, in order to build a nuclear bomb, you need huge facilities. You need to spend tons and tons of money. You have to have brilliant, brilliant people, and a lot of them, to build your bomb. And that was, you know, and even then, a nuclear bomb is less scary than what a single individual working in a trailer house somewhere could put together if they had the right equipment and the right know-how.
Exactly.
And so... and you know, how do you spot that person, the troubled genius that hides out in the back 40 somewhere, puts together something that could potentially kill a lot of people, if not all of us? So, you know, I completely agree. That's the big one. I think the risk of this world coming to an end in a nuclear holocaust has diminished. Since, you know, basically the Cold War ended, I think perhaps the risk of a regional nuclear war may have increased. But a regional nuclear war doesn't wipe us all out. It may wipe out a few cities, but that's not the same as a nuclear holocaust that kills everybody. So I think that risk has actually gone down, but the risk of putting together a bug to kill us all, that's actually gone up. I've heard it put this way, that every year, you know, there's, you know, we talk about accelerating change. Well, the downside of that is that every year the amount of the IQ level of someone that it would take to wipe out the world goes down too. So,
that's Eliezer Yudkowsky has stated that. It's the law of accelerating change for mad scientists or something like that?
I don't know, but he said it a lot more concisely than that. But, that's
exactly right. The point is, with all of these technologies, with the exception of nuclear, I'll come back to nuclear, but with biotech, nanotech, and artificial intelligence, this is the dark, scary side of an army of Davids. This is a tremendous power pushed down into the hands of individuals. And in fact, to the extent that nuclear risk is still a fairly big risk, it has, I think, more to do with that, more with smaller groups and individuals getting their hands on that capability and using it than the traditional nuclear risk that guys like us grew up with, which was huge state actors who had the capacity to blow each other up many times over, launching the all-out global thermonuclear war that wiped out civilization. I think the greater nuclear risk now is that nuclear destruction may have been democratized to some extent, and you have individuals who can cause tremendous damage with that. Certainly with all the rest of those, that's the real risk, is that someone gets a hold of biotechnological capability that makes it possible for them to, you know, unleash this designer virus, or that someone working on a completely legitimate problem with nanotech accidentally builds the gray goo machine, right? The machine that then turns around and eats the world.
Yeah.
And I've heard it jokingly said, but I don't know if it's entirely a joke, that where artificial intelligence might well arise is from the financial markets. Because we now have the situation where currently trading is done to a large extent by algorithms. And we've got these very smart people, these quants, who write these algorithms, and they're looking for tiny advantages over each other in terms of what goes into my algorithm that's going to make me make a purchase a little faster, a little more aggressively, with a little bit more insight than yours does. So there's this kind of arms race going on between the financial services firms to build these better and better algorithms. Eventually, we won't have the quants doing it. Eventually, we will have software writing those algorithms. And when that happens, You've got the exact scenario for a continuously improving intelligent agent in place that could very well lead to some form of artificial general intelligence. And you have to think that something built in to serve such an aggressive market and to perform such a competitive feat might not be terribly friendly or terribly empathetic or concerned about what we think of as the major concerns of humanity if it were to come into being.
Wow. You know, a while back I wrote a post called "The Big Risk," and in it I listed off the 10 risks that had been published by a newspaper, The Guardian, and the 10 risks that The Guardian mentioned was climate change, telomere erosion, viral pandemic, terrorism, nuclear war, meteorite impact, robot takeover, which AI basically, unfriendly AI, cosmic ray blast, supervolcano, and artificial black hole. I went through and just basically said, okay, here's the upsides and downsides of it. The one that I came away saying the biggest risk of all of these is a robot takeover, or basically unfriendly AI. But, you know, I think viral pandemic is probably a close second. So, at any rate, I hate to be we're kind of getting into a pessimistic show here, Phil.
Well, you know, we're not pessimistic because, once again, coming up very soon, we're going to have our friends from the Lifeboat Foundation on. They're going to tell us what we can do to
Yeah. Well, what can we do to actually make sure this doesn't happen, huh?
Right. And meanwhile, I would suggest that anyone who is concerned about these things, if you're worried about nanotechnological risk, obviously you want to get involved with the work of Foresight Nanotech or the Center for Responsible Nanotechnology. If you're concerned about the AI risk, there's the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence. They're working specifically on addressing this problem, making sure that the first AI that shows up is a friendly AI. And, of course, the Lifeboat Foundation itself, which is dedicated to addressing all of these risks. And they're looking at not just the ones we've listed here, but some of those that you were talking about. They're tracking meteor impacts. And now, telomere erosion is more of an individual threat, is it not, than a or am I misunderstanding that one?
Well, telomere erosion basically says that, they're saying that this type of telomere erosion would actually be species-wide. But, you know, I've never heard of a species being wiped out because there's some time limit on species.
Well, of course you've never heard of it because none of them were here to tell the story.
Well, think about it this way. If we had turtle, if it was a problem, we wouldn't have turtles because turtles have been around forever, right? We wouldn't have, I don't know, alligators or some of these species that have been with us since, you know, the time of the dinosaurs. Those species, if there was really a time limit on a species, then, you know, why are those species still around? So I didn't put any credence in that. That was one that I basically threw out immediately and said, okay, here's the other nine that are listed here. You know, are these?
Okay, really, well, certainly if it applies to all species, then, yeah, you would think we've got at least as long as mosquitoes.
Right.
And we know they've been around for, I don't know, hundreds of millions of years, right? So
yeah, so I didn't put any stock.
Don't need to worry about that. But maybe it applies to some species more rapidly than others or something like that. But anyway,
yeah,
I don't know. I just, that one caught my attention because I am familiar with that being an issue related to aging. And obviously it leads to existential risk on the most personal and, you know, self-centered levels, which is, you know, it's one of the reasons that we get older and it's one of the reasons that ultimately die. So there is an existential risk associated with telomere erosion. I didn't see.
But we're not going to all die at once.
Right.
The children, our children will survive us more than likely. So that's, yeah, exactly. I see telomere erosion as a personal risk and not a risk to the entire species. So I chunked that one.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Well, we'll stop worrying about that one, and hopefully next week or in the very near future, we'll have our friends with us from Lifeboat, and they'll talk to us about what we can expect to see in place addressing those, and what people can do to get involved in terms of mitigating some of these risks, because there are real risks, and they definitely do need to be looked at. This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. All right, Stephen, why don't we shift gears a little bit and talk about some maybe less serious and less threatening topics. I think you had kind of a fun one about giant robots that we could giant military robots. Why don't you talk to us about
that?
Well,
actually, the topic was things we would have if things weren't so expensive. If it wasn't so expensive, what kind of great science fiction things would we have? Well, you know, one of the things it listed was you know, giant robots like the Gundam, or is that what you call them?
Gundam, yeah.
Gundam, yeah. Robots like. You know, it's in the Japanese anime. There are so many things that are science fiction tropes that we could have that would be possible, but you know, we just don't do it because it's so expensive. Moon base is still in the future. I think we will live to see that, Phil. But we would have had it already, probably in the mid-70s, had it had money but no option. We could have had it. You know, orbital hotels. Things like that.
By the way, does Mars Colony show up on that list by any chance?
Yes, a manned mission to Mars, I think, is on the list.
Because not just a manned mission, but an established settlement there we could have had, and it wouldn't have cost as much if people had just listened to our friend Robert Zubrin, who is...
Yeah, he's got a pretty good idea on how to get there and to do it on the cheap, which you basically have to do when you're talking about something like that. I mean, there's... You know,
right, because otherwise we're talking about trillions and trillions of dollars if you go the conventional method. And getting back to it, that's why we wouldn't have had it. Now let's talk about these Gundam mecha robots. What would you be able to do with one of these? It looks like from the picture these guys stand about 60 feet tall. Is that right?
And, yeah, I mean you're talking basically a mechanized Godzilla. You know, that would be obviously a great thing to have with you on your side if you were going to war. You know, the Bible story of David and Goliath. You know, the whole Philistine army hangs back and they just send out this big giant to completely demoralize the other side. Well, imagine if you had this 60-foot tall robot. I mean. To a certain extent, that would just your enemy would just probably lay down their arms, try to negotiate for surrender if you start showing up with 60-foot tall robots.
Or they found out that you've built one and they've now got an 80-foot robot.
That's right.
This is where the arms race really starts to take off in a fun way. I mean, at least fun in an entertaining way to watch.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to be involved in this, but...
no, you wouldn't want to be anywhere near this.
You wouldn't want to be a soldier on the ground that's getting stomped by one of these things.
No, you want a robotic camera crew recording the whole thing and to watch it later.
That's right. Well, the cost that was put in this article, $725 million per robot is what they would estimate it would cost. You know, I don't know how they necessarily came to that, but, you know, obviously it would be great to have in warfare. Apparently, some of the Japanese comic books, that have these... Gundam robots in them. They also show them being used for more peaceful purposes, you know, building skyscrapers and things like that. So,
why sure? Search and rescue. It seems like there's a lot of great stuff you can do with them once you had them. All kind of. I think there could be a tremendous peacetime dividend related to building the Gundam Mecha if we build an army of them, establish our military dominance over the entire world, and then let them. Well, I guess they would basically take over at that point. Never mind.
Probably. Yeah, maybe we don't do that. I don't know.
But that whole establishing our military dominance was a bad idea too. I was just kidding. but the thing I remember reading in that article was that some commenter noted that at $725 million, one of these would actually cost you less than a B-1 bomber.
Yeah. So I mean.
So. It sounds outrageously expensive, but hey, you know, we're spending that much on military hardware anyway, and it's cool.
Maybe just have a couple of them just to completely, again, demoralize the enemy.
Yeah, or just to walk down the street in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. I mean, it's just
yeah,
awesome thing to have. I don't know. But anything else that was on the list that that you'd want to make note of?
Well, something that wasn't on the list was the Project Orion. You remember that? That was the project that was a nuclear powered spaceship that we never got. That we basically cut that and just went, put all of our eggs in the rocket basket, basically, so we could get to the moon as quickly as possible. But Project Orion, they had as their slogan, Saturn by 1970.
Wow.
And, the idea was, we're going to launch this thing. And this is not a spaceship like any that we've ever launched before. It's not, small. It's not cramped. It's a big, huge battleship of a spaceship that would be launched on a plume of nuclear warheads, basically.
The application that I remember reading about for Orion was not so much even interplanetary travel within our solar system, but where it would really start to come into its own would be as the sort of rudimentary starship that by firing enough of these. I remember Carl Sagan's description of this in the book Cosmos. He talks about you start firing these nuclear bombs in rapid succession, and eventually what you've got is kind of like the putt, 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 as he described it, of a motorcycle engine, and that's going to push that spaceship out into interstellar space, and eventually, if I remember correctly, the Orion spacecraft would get you up to about 10% of light speed. So it's no Starship Enterprise, but that is at least a...
That would be a 40-year journey, I guess, to the local, to the next star.
To the nearest star, yeah.
Yeah, so it'd need to be a huge ship, obviously, to do that, but yeah, that's if we had put our money into that, perhaps we could have already have been at least exploring the solar system by now. So that's a shame, and I wish we had I wish we had put some more money into that and pursued that a little bit more. But yeah, that should have been on the list.
Yeah, that would have been a good one. And for one thing, because I would really like to have seen the estimate for how much that would have cost.
Yeah.
That would have been very interesting. Well, now let's talk about, did you see this Discover Magazine article, 20 Things You Didn't Know About Science Fiction?
No.
This was good fun. Discover Magazine, they the title kind of cutesy. It said 20 Things You Didn't Know About, and then... .. science fiction. So you think, oh, you're going to get some science topic, but instead they're giving us science fiction. And I have to say that I read through the list, and I knew most of them, and some of them that I didn't know, I would take issue with.
Yeah.
For example, number one, arguably, see right off, they're giving you an out there.
Okay?
Yeah. Arguably, the inspiration for much science fiction traces back to classical mythology. Think of it, Earthlings abducted by beings from the sky, humans morphing into strange creatures, and events that defy the laws of nature. Now, I would say that fantasy derives from classical mythology, but that, in fact, science fiction is a... when it was developed, it was a new thing, and that it did not come from classical mythology. And definitely there's overlaps between fantasy and science fiction.
Well, I kind of take the other side on that, Phil.
Okay.
And the reason is, I think... Arguably, the first arguably the first science fiction story is what? Frankenstein. I would say that.
Okay. Yes. All right. And subtitled the modern.
Subtitled the modern Prometheus. Right.
Wow. Oh, you got me, man.
Okay. Well.
Okay.
So maybe corrected. Maybe science fiction owes a lot to classical mythology. So
arguably, I would say it does.
That's right.
Anything on the list that got your attention?
Well, taking a look here.
Another one that I was amused by was number 15. Sexual liberation plays a big role in Heinlein's books, which really puts the waterbed thing into perspective. Oh, I should have gotten back to the earlier one. Robert A. Heinlein actually. Outlined the first model of a working waterbed in, I think it was in Stranger in a Strange Land. There's a description of a waterbed.
For a waterbed that doesn't suck. I hate waterbeds, man. If you can get them to be warm, if you get the temperature thing right, you still got the, your wife getting out of bed and, you know, you're rocking in the middle of the night and waking up and all that. Water beds are terrible.
And that feeling that you're sinking, that strange, I'm drowning,
Again, this is my personal opinion. Maybe there are people out there that love them, but no.
But, callers, once again, we are taking your calls and argue the merits of the waterbed. We do have a few more minutes here. Now, another one that that got my attention was about Isaac Asimov, and now I'm not seeing the one that I wanted to talk about, Isaac Asimov. Oh, rats. Anyway, there was one on there about Isaac Asimov that I wanted to. Here it is. Not to be outdone, science fiction legend Isaac Asimov wrote about interstellar spaceflight but refused to board an airplane. And
he never flew in his life.
Would not fly.
Wow.
I know that he traveled to Europe, so he must have taken
like a boat.
A boat, yeah. And this follows on Ray Bradbury, who would never even drive a car, would have nothing to do with computers or ATMs, and won't drive a car. It's really amazing, these guys with these astounding...
Who is the author of Neuromancer?
Yeah, me too.
For years, I think, and until very, very recently, he didn't own a computer. I mean, he had all these ideas of what computers could do and where it could go, but he was bored by the brick that was sitting on your desk, you know.
That's amazing.
That's
William Gibson.
William Gibson. Yeah.
William Gibson is the name. Well, in fact, I remember reading an article written by Isaac Asimov on the first computer that he ever used. And it was for Reader's Digest or some popular interest magazine, and he was talking about, you know, getting the hang of the keyboard and all that kind of thing. And this was my addition to the list of little known facts about science fiction, is that Isaac Asimov, in addition to the fact that he didn't like to fly, he never learned touch typing, and the man wrote more than 300 books using what he would have described as two-finger typing, what a lot of people call the hunt and peck method. So imagine that, 300 books, just kind of pecking them.
Ooh,
out.
That's a slow way to go. But, you know, I've seen a pretty fast hunt and peck guys.
I've actually read that the fastest typist in the world, who can type much faster than the fastest touch typist, use that method. I've never seen that demonstrated.
I don't know how that could be possible. How can someone beat me with two fingers when I'm using 10?
I don't know.
Or at least
eight. I've heard it. Yeah. It might have something to do with the fact that it could be that you can go a lot faster with those two fingers than you can with, you know, the other fingers are even at their fastest maybe or not nearly as fast as those. I don't know. But I mention this because I am going to come out of the closet here. I am actually a two-finger typist myself. Have never learned to hunt and peck. Never learned to touch typing. I use the
You
same
have written
method.
A lot at the Speculist with two fingers, my friend.
That's right. The same method that Isaac Asimov used for those 300-plus books he wrote. So it's out now. He was a
prolific writer, and you are as well.
He's my cover for the fact that I never learned touch typing. I can say, yeah, well, Isaac Asimov, so there.
And you're pretty fast. I know that because, text chatting back and forth. You type pretty quickly.
I do what I can. And there have been times when a story would break, and we'd both put a blog post up on the same subject at the same time. Sometimes you'd be first, sometimes I'd be first. So I think we're just about evenly matched. Although the word counts wouldn't necessarily be the same. So I guess that's not scientific. Okay, one other was number six. Are you familiar with this? Serious science fiction heads say sci-fi carries schlocky B-movie connotations. Many prefer the abbreviation SF. Were you
serious science fiction heads say sci-fi carries schlocky B-movie connotations. They prefer SF. Okay. Whatever.
Because I know that you use the term sci-fi.
All the time.
I don't use the term sci-fi. And I've often wondered if that's actually an old school kind of a thing. I look at that and I go, well, yeah, but isn't that more like in the 70s people said that? And that's not really an issue today.
Well, it's the difference between Trekker and Trekkie, I guess.
It could be related to that as well. Well, with that in mind, why don't we talk about what music we got going on this evening?
Oh, okay. Well, let's see. Let me get to where I'm looking at it here. Tonight we have got Scott Andrew, More Good Days. And I'm glad it's an upbeat song this evening after talking about some things. A little
after talking
bit,
all that risk, let's talk about
More Good Days Than Bad Days. So that's our music tonight. We have links to this music and all the topics we're talking about are in our show notes. You can find that at The Speculist, www.blog.speculist.com. And so it's been fun tonight, Phil.
It has been a pleasure, as always. Thanks so much for spending the time with me, Stephen. And for all of those of you listening, thank you. We look forward to being with you once again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Good night.
I'm spending too long with the sad songs. Rain is coming down over me. You tell me you could do with a bit more time, but I think that you'd rather be free. See, I heard you've been down, no one comes around, and not too many hours to spare. So come on, let me take you away from here. We'll burn for the horizon, let it be a last souvenir. So turn the bed down, take the needle out. Let me help you into your shoes. Only you could say how your story ends. You're the only one who can choose. And now we're long gone on the 101, and we got nothing better to do. Think about the last time you felt this high, with the sun in the sky and the vibe I'm sending to you. More good days than bad days. It's good to be on your own. More good days than bad days. You don't have to go it alone. Now on the blacktop at the Mission Rock, you've got no destination in mind. Put your arm around me as I pull you close. Just pick a new direction and drive. And pay the last toll as the credits roll. As another day comes to an end, let it wrap you in a blanket of desert sky. With the light in your eyes, let me see you shine once again. More good days than bad days. Yeah, it's good to be on your own. More good days than bad days. But you don't have to go it alone. California.